In our final look at low-tech interactivity this hour, in the theater these days, sometimes as a member of the audience, you're made to feel like the enemy.
Please remain seated. Please don't be so noisy.
Armed with weapons of mass disruption.
Please be quiet and courteous to others and silence your cell phones now.
But increasingly in live theater, often described as on the ropes due to alternative screen-based forms of entertainment, the audience is really getting into the act.
Fingers crossed.
Becoming a part of the show.
I was told there would be vodka.
Oh, good.
We have the back four seats here.
Okay. Fabulous. Look at this play.
Receiving benefits way beyond that bucket of bad popcorn in a plastic chair with cup holders.
Can we order a drink? Let's get a bottle. Are they going to perform, do you think, like right in front of us?
Probably. It's huge.
Wow.
Welcome to the Theater of the Interactive. These are audience members getting ready to see the New York stage sensation Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, where audience members are not scolded for having smartphones. They are encouraged to drink, socialize, or take part in the actual production, short of being dragged on stage. But in the interactive showbiz world, you can even get on stage in some shows. When our good pal Charlie Herman is not reporting on business and economics for Takeaway co-producer WNYC, he's what you might call a one-man stimulus program for the theater. He sees all the shows, knows it all, and we ask Charlie if theater directors are embracing this as a random fad or a real trend to meet all the small screen competition.
I think it's a trend that you're seeing an increase in these type of shows that are very immersive and you're part of it. But this has been something that's been around for a while, whether it's, you know, types of shows like Blue Man Group, where you see, you know, the guys on stage and the different things that they're doing, sort of bringing up audience members. If you go back to the 60s, there was a lot of very immersive theater. And if you take it all the way back in Shakespeare's time, you know, you had people in the pit who were interacting with the audience and what was going on. So it may not be a new thing, but there seems to be a definite upswing in the amount of programs like this.
I'm interested in how, you know, while Blue Man Group just gets an audience member up to kind of poke fun at them, with Natasha, Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, the proximity of the audience adds to the theatrical tension.
Yeah, I mean, you are in basically a Russian supper club. You are brought in, you are seated at a table, a waiter comes up to you and will talk to you with a very strong Russian accent. It probably is an actor. You get a full meal, you have drinks, and the show happens all around you. The show is a part of War and Peace by Tolstoy, and they're all in period costume, but they're singing very modern language, very modern songs. And, I mean, you could reach out and touch the people or fight scenes that happen next to you, and you feel very engaged with it. It's very similar to another show that just closed recently called Here Lies Love. It's a musical about Imelda Marcos, and it's music from David Byrne and Fatboy Slim, and it takes place in a disco. You are in the disco yourself because Imelda Marcos loved discos. She went to Studio 54. She reportedly had discos in the Presidential Palace. And so it's actually an integral part of the show, the fact that you were at this disco, to really understand who she was.
Just say.
You're allowed to sort of respond to it, to be more engaged with it. And if you think about it, that's something that we do all the time when we go to sporting events, that other big dramatic thing. We yell at players we like or we don't like. We really get engaged with it and we feel part of it. And that's why we're so passionate about it. I think in a way, theater recently is trying to recapture that sense.
Are people demanding this in the same way that they demand different kinds of experiences in museums, where you have a big rise in young museum goers taking advantage of different kinds of experiences that in the 60s we might have called happenings?
You know, I think so. I mean, if you look here in New York, there's been a huge amount of artistic events recently. Like at the Museum of Modern Art, there was an event called the Rain Room, where you walked into this large room where it's raining, and wherever you walked, it wasn't raining. You actually were part of the art exhibit. In Columbus Circle, there's a large statue of Christopher Columbus. They built an enormous living room around him with Christopher Columbus in the middle of it, and wallpaper and TV screens. Last year, there was an exhibit at the Park Avenue Armory called 42 Swings. Swings everywhere, and you could just go in and swing, and you were part of it. So I think there seems to be this push in the artistic community to find ways to get people to be part of it. I think it's very similar to what you're seeing on online and social media, where people can interact and play more of an active role than just a passive role.
And it's different than the kind of lure them in with special effects, the Spider-Man, Take Back the Dark kind of thing, make the production values better, have stars be on stage. This is really enlarging the genre, experimenting with what theater is actually all about and maybe getting back to what theater is all about.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when you look back at Shakespearean times and even after that, you know, theater was often not necessarily the highfalutin kind of thing that we see now. You could have theater in bars. You could have theater in all sorts of different places. And the audience participating in the theater or reacting to what was going on was something that was not uncommon. The one professor that I spoke with, Frank Hilde, who's a professor, theater professor at the University of Maryland, he thought in 1875, when Richard Wagner turned down the lights in the auditorium for one of his operas and basically forced the audience to sit there passively and watch the show and at appropriate times clap or cheer, was really the beginning of a turn. And so what we think now perhaps is the standard, we sit there very passively, watch a theatrical production, clap, and then leave, may not actually be what was really the tradition. And we're kind of getting back into that. And it makes it more thrilling. It makes it more exciting. Makes you want to go to the theater.
So if it hadn't been for Wagner, we wouldn't be being told to turn off our cell phones, to turn off our screens. It might have been just sort of allowed. Oh, there's another gadget they're bringing in.
I don't want to blame Wagner for everything, but he definitely, that sort of set a precedent clearly.
So if young people are coming into the theater armed with Instagram and smartphones and you know, their impulse is to socially interact in almost any situation, and they probably do it when they go to the movies. Does theater embrace that sort of thing and come up with scripts that tries to create opportunities for people to interact online? Or does it want to go in the other direction, basically so focus people's attention that maybe that would never happen?
I think it really depends on the show. I mean, when I talked to the producer for Natasha and Pierre, his hope was that people would be so engaged with what they were seeing, so feel part of it that they wouldn't even want to pull out their phone and interact, or that they would want to be in the show and be totally immersed. I'm sure at the same time there are some producers, some directors out there right now who are thinking, what are ways that we can get people to use their phone to interact with the actors on stage, maybe to do things that could change the sets or the lights? I think it's great. If trying to find interesting ways to engage audiences, however that may be, can only be a benefit to the whole overall theatrical experience.
And theater, the history of theater is about this figuring out ways of dealing with the proliferation of media that
exactly
has been going on since the very first plays were produced.
Exactly. And, you know, to tie it back to a business perspective, if they want to be viable, if they want to be able to stay alive, they have to find ways to tap into this to keep their doors open and to keep the audiences coming.
You hear him normally talking about business and economics here at WNYC, Charlie Herman on theater and the more immersive opportunities to experience theater here in New York. Thanks, Charlie.
You bet.
Our business and economics editor at co-producer WNYC. What do you think about how your online presence reflects on who you are, kind of a costume in the theater of life? How much of what you do online would you want to reveal?
My name's Kendra. I'm calling from Tacoma, and I'm pretty sure that my online footprint screams crazy dog lady.
Hey, crazy dog lady. That's all right. You can call us anytime. The concern extends to Diego from Fort Lauderdale. For you, your online footprint leaves behind nothing good if I wanted to be a politician. Oh, come on. That's changing very quickly. And in Portland, Oregon, it's all about self-control. I avoid leaving any footprints online, no Facebook account. I expect the FBI and NSA are looking at everything I do online. Those paranoid folks in the Pacific Northwest. Love them. Have your say at 8778MyTake. Follow us at Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.